This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest on Keeping the Faith today is with us by telephone in Chicago at his home. We're talking with Dr. Jay Wilcoxon about study Bibles. Welcome, Jay. Can you hear me okay?
Hi, Steve. I can hear you fine.
Oh,
glad
great.
To be with you.
And more importantly, your voice is coming through just fine, too.
Good.
Let me start off by telling how I've invited Dr. Jay to be on our program today. I've appreciated so much his lectionary helps that are found on the website of the Protestants for the Common Good organization in Illinois. It can be found at thecommongood.org, and then you look for Read the Lectionary, and then you'll find his very helpful commentary for the passages of Scripture that many Christian churches around the world are using for the upcoming Sunday, and in fact, the upcoming month. He keeps about four or five weeks ahead. And he's done this for a number of years, and I know many pastors, Protestant, Catholic, and others who look at these, if I may say so, religiously, they're very helpful as pastors prepare for those sermons that they're going to give, homilies on those texts. And, of course, many lay people find it very helpful to have your take on it, either before or after they may hear a sermon. In addition, you've added a section on that same website, thecommongood.org, where you talk about study Bibles, current study Bibles. Let's start off, what is a study Bible?
Well, a study Bible can be distinguished from other works such as full-scale commentaries and so on, in that a study Bible contains the full text of a Bible, the Bible that this particular work is focused on, plus usually introductions and running commentaries at the foot of the page as you go through the various sections of the Scripture. And then there are typically also essays at the beginning and particularly at the back of most study Bibles about history and times, the particular tradition that this Bible represents, maps and things of that sort. Basically, a study Bible is an attempt to put into one almost always large volume most of the things that an ordinary Bible reader is likely to need or want in the course of just basic personal study reading of the Bible.
Now, in this program today, we're going to try to talk about several of these that you've studied in depth in your contribution to the Common Good website. But we're talking about a Jewish study Bible. We're talking about Christian study Bibles during this hour. And one thing you point out in your very helpful series is that these are very convenient. You can carry this one book around. As you say, it's rather large, but it's very portable and large enough print you can read, even the notes at the bottom or in the center of the page.
And they all have a great deal packed into them. They vary from each other sometimes in just how they package their materials and so on, and particularly they vary from each other in the audiences that they're aimed at. But I have not worked with one of these Bibles yet that's not full of materials that, you know, are moderately inexhaustible on any normal Bible study scale. They're really loaded works.
Now, we're going to talk about some Bibles that are used in the colleges and universities, like the Oxford Annotated Bible, the HarperCollins Study Bible. We're also going to talk about some that are very interesting historically. And so let's before we jump right into those, though, let me let people know a little bit about your background. How did you get interested in studying the Bible originally, and where have you been in school and studied all that?
I've basically had three careers. I grew up in Southern California, and at that time I was interested in going into the teaching of Bible. And at that time, my assessment, this is 1954, assessment was I had to come at least as far east as Chicago to get the best theological seminaries, and I ended up at Chicago Theological Seminary, affiliated with the University of Chicago in those days, ended up doing my own PhD work here at the University of Chicago, and stayed on the faculty for another 20 years before I kind of burned out on the academic world, and spent 15 years in hospital administration, retired from that, and for the last 15 years have been chief financial officer for Protestants for Common Good and writer of lectionary and study Bible materials for Protestants for the Common Good.
And how long did it take you to get that PhD at the University of Chicago?
I spent my first three graduate student years were, and back in those days, the ministry degree was a Bachelor of Divinity. I spent 3 years doing a Bachelor of Divinity. Then I spent three more years doing graduate study in, well, in those days we still call Old Testament. That included a year of study at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. And then I worked on my dissertation for the following 6 years after that while I was teaching. So I actually got my PhD in 1967, having entered my BD work in 1955.
Of course, many people know that the University of Chicago for decades has had a reputation of it takes a long time to get that doctorate, particularly
right.
In the field of religion.
Yes.
Well, congratulations for doing all that, and again, I thank you for how much you've contributed to so many people over the years, particularly in recent years through the commongood.org website.
It's been a means for me to sustain, you know, Bible studies. Always, even though I left the university, I didn't leave my subject matter and area, and Al Sharp asked me one day, would you contribute a column to the brand new, freshly created Common Good News, now called? And it just left me a blank sheet. Do whatever you want to. And I got started, and it's been at that almost a decade now. It's been a marvelous opportunity for me to, you know, revive and sustain and extend my lifelong biblical study interests.
And I might thank you again for making a special effort to be on the radio with us today, leaving the regional meeting of the Society of Biblical Literature. We may talk about that a little bit later when we get to talking about the HarperCollins Study Bible. Let's jump in first with the Jewish Study Bible. It's a very recent publication, tell us about it.
It was kind of a new venture for there was nothing quite like that in the mainline Jewish English language study materials. There were Torahs with the weekly readings of the books of Moses that are used in the synagogues on Sabbaths. Accompanied by readings from the prophets. Each Sabbath Sunday, there's a slice, 1/54 of the Torah, and an accompanying prophetic reading. And these had been printed. There were large mainline Jewish study Bibles that printed the Hebrew text and the English translation of that text plus commentaries. These had come into being from relatively early in the 20th century in England and the United States and were widespread. But the Jewish Study Bible that came out in 2005 was addressed to the American scene and world. And one of the two editors, general editors of the Jewish Study Bible, had already served as an associate editor on the third edition of the Oxford Annotated Bible, which is kind of the leading academic study Bible in the United States. So he brought a lot of experience and background to the creating of the Jewish Study Bible, which was also published, by the way, by Oxford University Press. So Oxford was interested in having this Jewish Study Bible spun off. But it's done exclusively by Jewish scholars, all of some standing and esteem. It incorporates it does not have the Hebrew text in it. It only has the English translation, the Jewish Publication Society translation of the Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. And then it has the translations, each book introduced and commented upon by some prominent Jewish scholar. And then a whole set of essays about the Bible and Jewish life, Jewish interpreters through the ages, and right on down to to the Bible in a contemporary Israeli society. The essay on that essay I found very interesting, what's been going on for the Jewish Bible in Israeli society, particularly since the 1970s, when Israeli political complexions moved significantly to the right. There's been kind of accompanying effect in the role of the Hebrew Bible in Jewish common public life that period. There's an essay about that. And so it's got the Jewish Study Bible has the Bible itself introduced and accompanied, but it's got a fascinating battery of essays on the Bible and Jewish history and interpretation, and Jewish women scholars, biblical scholars, and a range of things such as that. It's one of those things that's, you know, nearly inexhaustible. I cannot, you know, I review on it that's like 10 or 15 pages long, you print it out, but I have no sense of having exhausted that work at all.
I enjoyed reading particularly some of those essays in the back that you highlight in your review, and I might just say that from reading your reviews of these various study Bibles, my good spouse is a little bit nervous every time she goes to our mailbox out in front, because here comes another big, thick book. They're not terribly expensive, but if you buy very many of them, it adds up.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Well, in a sense, I originated this project because I had been writing on the lectionary materials for several cycles through. And over the time, I have come particularly to appreciate brevity.
Yes.
And so study Bibles have represented for me the opportunity to put the most important things to say about biblical books in short form.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's not what I get, not even a majority of the time, but I turn to study Bibles hoping that I can find, you know, a real searching always for the gem, the real right word. I might just add another word on this item. When I was a graduate student, I spent a year of relatively advanced study at Hebrew Union College. And
a Jewish institution.
Right. In fact, this was the original American base of Reform Judaism, founded in the 1840s. Had a professor there who I had been already been into these advanced, detailed, complicated biblical study things and so on. But I was hearing the professor saying these, you know, relatively simple, straightforward things, and I was writing them down. It gradually dawned on me that the things he was saying, if you let them sink in a little while, were in fact very profound. Alfred North Whitehead said, you know, there are three stages in every discipline. There's the romantic stage, in which you get excited about a subject. Then there's the discipline stage, where you learn all the skills and techniques and everything you need, and that goes on a long time. And finally, there is the stage of wisdom, where you can bring it together and put it in succinct, powerful form. That's what I was hearing from this professor. I took four courses from him in three quarters because I gradually caught on that he had a great capacity to express this, you know, the essence of these things in succinct form. I've always searched for that, so I hope.
What was his name?
Professor Sheldon Blank. He's deceased now. But
B-L-A-N-K?
B-L-A-N-K, yes.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Dr. J. Wilcoxon. How do you pronounce your last name? I've heard it said so many different
emphasis
ways.
Emphasis on the first syllable, Wilcoxon.
Wilcoxon. All right. I'll try to do that better. And this is a live call-in show here on WILL every Sunday night from 5 to 6. Listeners are encouraged to join the conversation at 333-9455 if you're in the 217 area code here in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois area. If you're listening long distance, there's a toll-free number you may use, 1-800-222-9455. Let's talk a little bit about the study Bible that's used most in colleges and universities, the Oxford Annotated Bible that's now in, what, its fourth edition?
Yes, its fourth edition came out in 2010. I treated it as kind of an institution, which it had become by the 21st century. It started in 1962. The Revised Standard Version had come out in 1952, and there was a kind of an agreement not to use the text in various other ways until for a decade. And as soon as that decade expired, Oxford came out with a study Bible with American scholars. They were almost all, everyone in the first edition were American scholars. And that OAB, that was my first year of teaching when that Bible came out. And I bought that, and it became my standard text Bible for teaching for decades thereafter.
And really across the English-speaking world.
Yeah, I mean, I was one among a great man. Yes, it was a kind of a groundbreaker. And a model. It was called the Annotated Bible. The study Bible phrase hadn't caught on yet, but it was done by liberal, scholarly, academic writers, so colleges and increasingly after the 1960s, universities focused on it as an appropriate base for public institution use, and it's led the field in textbooks for courses, college and university courses in related to or in Bible.
I used it here at the University of Illinois when I was filling in for a professor on sabbatical teaching a New Testament, for example, or introduction to the Bible as literature.
There you are. Yeah. Speaking of University of Illinois, in the late 60s, the state of Illinois legislature approved the use of tax monies for teaching religion in the curriculum of the university only in 1968.
It was very late, yeah.
And the first course taught there, I taught. I commuted down from the Divinity School on Tuesdays, the autumn semester and taught it. And Norman Perrin commuted down the following. The legislature had only acted soon enough for them to simply buy some courses for the coming year, they spent that year acquiring new faculty members. But I finally remember commuting in the autumn of 1968 down to Champaign-Urbana and teaching that.
That would have been driving on Highway 45 before I-57 was built, probably, right?
I rode the train.
Oh, you did?
Right.
Good plan.
The train there in Highway. I only took 2 hours each way, and I got there in time to do a morning class, have office hours between, an afternoon class, and another 45 minutes for office, and catch, every other week I would catch the city of New Orleans back. But that was new, and that really changed teaching. It changed the scene, particularly for graduate education. Places like the Divinity School had well-established programs in biblical studies, and suddenly, it was a seller's market, if you know what I mean. Our graduates were in demand because teaching of religion in public public-supported institution that was still relatively new. This was the audience that grabbed the Oxford Annotated Bible and, you know, made it so pervasive.
Now, it's you mentioned it was filled mainly with American scholars. What about later editions?
Of the Oxford Annotated?
Yeah.
The first two editions, or actually there were more than two, but it was a little, it's a little hard to count. I think there are two main editions of the original one. And then a new translation came out in 1989, the New Revised Standard Version. And so Oxford chose that occasion to redo the whole thing. And so they started with a whole new set of editors and contributors. That didn't actually get out public until 2001. But that was a sea change because the world had changed between 1962, biblical studies were still dominated by white Protestant males. By 2001, there are a lot of women in it. There are Roman Catholics in it. And a kind of a whole new scene had taken place.
And racial minorities.
Beg your pardon?
And racial minorities and international
scholars. Yeah, the third edition of 2001 had, and I'm sorry the name skipped my name now, but the commentator on John was from New York University, African-American scholar. Israeli contributors, Canadian contributors, Latin American contributors. Yeah, it ceased to be parochial in almost any category you want to use by 2001 and became even more cosmopolitan and inclusive by the 2010 edition, the one that's currently on the markets.
Now let's talk a little bit, Jay Wilkerson, about the HarperCollins competition that came out to the HarperCollins Study Bible. This was a tell us when it came out and it was a project with the Society for Biblical Literature. Tell us about
right.
that society.
When I did this review, I put the focus on the distinctiveness of the HarperCollins Bible. It was a marriage of a major publishing house. HarperCollins had, as by that name, had just been formed in 1988-89. Harper was an American house, and Collins was a British house, and they had been merged by Murdoch in 1988. But rather than appoint a major, the publishing house appointing a major general editor who then recruited associate editors and contributors, as had happened with the Oxford Annotated, they entered into an agreement with the Society of Biblical Literature, then a 100-year-old professional society of biblical professors in North America mainly, though by the 1980s and 90s it was international as well.
And this would be Christian and Jewish scholars.
Yes, by that time there were Jewish scholars, there were Roman Catholic and Jewish scholars that were members of the Society of Biblical Literature. Your qualification for membership in the society always were matters of degrees, in more ways than one, and competence, not matters of profession of faith. There was never any, never in the later years, any criteria of religious orientation. It was strictly a scholarly measurement. And
there were atheists who were part of the Society for Biblical Literature because they were scholars in the biblical literature.
Exactly. Sure. Yes, by the 1980s, there were those who had no personal profession of religion at all, but
sure.
were biblical scholars.
Sure.
HarperCollins clearly came on as a direct competitor with the Oxford Annotated. And in my more recent years, I have always used the HarperCollins as my... the first year I went through, in fact, the first 4 years I did... lectionary studies, I completely wore out my, my HarperCollins Bible. It was literally falling out of the bindings and so on. So I got Al Sharp and Nancy Brandt to buy me another Bible replacement.
My HarperCollins also has been rebound.
Yes.
I had too many scribbles in it that I didn't want to lose. So.
But the Oxford Annotated and the HarperCollins are definitely in the same ballpark, and they are aimed at the university, the general teaching of religion in colleges and universities.
And what made you choose HarperCollins over the new Oxford Annotated?
Had a lot of people in it that I knew about.
Sure.
More than so did the Oxford, but those are my folks, as it were.
Sure. Well, when I was in graduate school, Dennis Dooling, who wrote the Matthew commentary, for example, in HarperCollins, was a friend, and so I had some of those same experiences.
Dennis Dooling was a student of Norman Perrin.
Yes.
And I sat in on his oral exam, and quite friendly with him for many years.
And he's been a guest on Keeping the Faith, talking about Matthew, back when Matthew was the gospel for the lectionary.
Great, I'll have to check that out.
And I might just mention that your most recent article found on the Common Good News, found at thecommongood.org, and then checking on Read the Lectionary, is on the gospel for this year for our most Christian churches on Mark. Who's been reading Mark lately is the title of your article. You talk about specific commentaries written just on that one gospel by that writer.
This article turned out, this started originally as I add to the lectionary things, besides just discussing the passage, I sometimes put in special note. I do a kind of blurb on something that's somehow related to the day's reading. And back at the beginning of year B, which was Advent of 2011, I decided I should tell people about all the Mark things that I've been using. I started this as a long, extended note. And one thing led to another, and I was just writing it. And it ended up being a long, I just let it go, just let it flow out. And sent it to Greenfield, who's the general editor, and he said, no, this is too good to be general notes. So it became an essay of, if I print this thing out, it's like 15, 17 pages long. What I offer is a chatty reminiscence of about 55 years of reading commentaries. And mind, that's just what it is. I mean, this is my personal take on commentaries of Mark, on Mark, that I have used. My subtitle for this thing is Commentaries on Mark I Have Known and Loved.
Uh-huh.
And there are some that are conspicuously missing, and, that's because I don't want to say anything about them. But it's a very personal kind of thing, though, particularly as you get down to the recent period. I think I covered the major ball players in the big scale Mark commentaries. These are, I learned Greek relatively early, and so I have used Greek commentaries quite a bit. And usually the mammoth things is where the mammoth commentaries draw together stuff that's been going on for the last 15 to 20 years ahead of time, if not longer, and kind of collect that all for, the next generation or two. So I plowed through a lot of those, enjoyed them, and had some fun at their expense sometimes and so on. And so basically this is a kind of personal reminiscence of reading Mark commentaries.
Now, since you're a biblical scholar as opposed to a concentration on theology, you may not have read Bill Plaker's theological commentary on Mark that was just out, I think, last year. I did read it last year and found it helpful. So I'll add that to your list. But we're about halfway through our program today, and I realize we've only covered three rather cursorily of these study Bibles, but at least we've introduced people to them and given them a little bit of way to think about it. We'll be going on in just a few minutes with several more with Dr. J. Wilcoxon, and from Chicago. And he is the author of a series on of study Bibles found at thecommongood.org, which is part of the Common Good News which is put out by Protestants for the Common Good here in the state of Illinois. And I might just mention, Jay, that you're an academic, of course, you're a scholar, but you also are interested in politics. Didn't I see you at Springfield just a week or two ago doing something about the minimum wage?
That's right. You and I were both down there.
Yeah, we were indeed.
First day that the legislature was in session.
That's right.
That was part of a day, Raise Illinois Day, that Protestants for the Common Good joined with them, and together we purchased an entire train car for 65 people to go down. And we were around and visited. Our entire group was divided up into little groups that were around. All 177 members of the legislature received a scroll with over 200 clergy signatures supporting a bill that will raise the minimum wage for the state of Illinois in the next 2 or 3 years. Yeah, I did that. My other hat, besides writing on Bible stuff, is I am the chief financial officer for Protestants for the Common Good, and have been since the beginning. I was just one of the troops going along and enjoying the adventure delightful day down there.
Of educating and lobbying. Well, I was one of those troops, too, and happy to join my voice to the cause. Well, as I say, we're halfway through the program. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the most usual host for this program. I've been doing it for 13 years now, and that's been one of my contributions to WILL. I do volunteer my time hosting this program and helping produce it, and I'd like to encourage other listeners to, since this is part one of our pledge drives for the year, to consider making a gift to WILL. The number to call to make a pledge is 217-244-9455. You can have a credit card ready to make a gift, or you can tell the folks who answers the phone how much you'd like to contribute, perhaps by a check, and they'll send you a reminder. You can also give online at willpledge.org. That's W-I-L-L, pledge, P-L-E-D-G-E, .org. It takes a lot of money to produce the programs that you like to hear on WILL, and if Keeping the Faith is one of those programs that you've found valuable over the years, please consider making a contribution. My wife and I give money every year, and as well as the time I contribute for this particular program. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, Jay Michelson, not two J's in a row here we have. He's going to be talking about the religious case for gay rights. Jay Michelson will be a guest of the Hillel Foundation here at the University of Illinois later next month. That's the Cohen Center for Jewish Student Life here at the campus in Champaign-Urbana. Christopher Mitchell will be our guest February 26th on Keeping the Faith. He'll be talking about the C.S. Lewis materials that can be found at the Wade Center in Wheaton, Illinois. On March 11th, we'll be talking about the upcoming crop walk here locally and that are happening around the country. Jackie Lynn will be our guest the first Sunday night in April, talking about the Episcopal Peace Fellowship. Oh, and I see I skipped another important one that I wanted to highlight. March 25th, we'll be learning about safe zones in Kenya from Esther Pointnoy and others. Those are some of the programs coming ahead on Keeping the Faith. The one I want to particularly highlight will be played right before Roger Ebert returns for another Ebert Fest movie festival here in Champaign-Urbana on April 22nd. We'll be playing an archive program where Roger Ebert talked about religious themes in movies. And since he's sadly lost his ability to speak over the last 3 years because of throat cancer, it'll be good to hear his voice again on that program from before the very first Overlooked Film Festival. Well, let's get back to talking about study Bibles. Why don't we look at the New International Version study Bibles? You talk about a couple of these in your and your very helpful online commentaries. Tell us about the NIV, the New International Version.
There's first the translation, and I was interested in the study Bible. It was built on the translation, but in this case in particular, the contributors and the general editor of the study Bible were themselves a carryover from the team that had done the translating, or coordinated the translating, there's a great many people involved in it, preceding that. So learning about that study Bible involved going back and learning about the translation.
And this is an evangelical group of scholars, so they identify themselves that way, right?
Yes, exactly. And they're quite polite and reserved in their prefatory comment about their relationship to the previous. The Revised Standard Version had come out, published by and owned by the National Council of Churches. It came out in 1952. And a large slice of American Protestantism felt that the Revised Standard Version had compromised one or another kinds of scriptural faithfulness items, and they backed away from it. And throughout the 50s, there was a variety of evangelical responses or speculations and so on. And other translations began to be made. I won't mention any other ones. But the NIV was the result of committees from the National Evangelical Association and the Reformed Synod based in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and together they created a committee that they appointed a committee that was then kind of blessed by large gatherings of the evangelical. The committee is called the Bible Translation Committee. It had an independent existence. It was not dependent on specific denominations or anything else. They were obviously afraid to turn over their translation to any particular group within the vast scale spectrum of evangelicalism. And I investigated a number of the people who were involved in that committee and who did the actual work of translation, and then particularly those who stayed on and worked as associate editors of the study Bible.
And I might just say those biographical statements that you include as part of your commentary on this were very helpful to understand who these people were.
Yeah, and, you know, they're the result of me learning all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
I want to know who gave me this Bible.
Thanks for sharing.
The study Bible. And I found intriguing stories and so on background. It was a nice exploration. You know, I've not been a true blue evangelical. I've been a kind of immediate neighbor for a long time. But this was a real adventure for me. I enjoyed going in and getting it. And I came to believe, you know, there was a significant integrity both to the translation that was done and to the work of the study Bible. And the study Bible did not attempt to overstate the case. They didn't venture into geology and biology or anything else. They stuck with kind of what's really out there to know about the biblical material. And I was impressed with the restraint exercised by the scholars. They were scholars who had gotten their educations and had proven themselves in their various denominations and schools in the 1960s. And I came to respect them very much and the work that they did. It was a solid piece of work. I came to value it. Even though I don't quite share the orientation, I admire the work.
And I know we're moving very quickly, but of course we only have 58 minutes. So tell us about the Jerusalem Bible and then the New Jerusalem Bible.
I dealt with both of those. That review has a warning at the beginning. If you're not interested in the historical background, skip to the Bible itself, because about half of the review. The New Jerusalem Bible, the Jerusalem Bible and then its extension as the New Jerusalem Bible, represent the great sea change of Roman Catholicism that came about. It became more public in Vatican II but had been going on for a while. And there was this major pontifical document of 1943, Divino Afflante Spiritu, which allowed Roman Catholic scholars to start studying and pursuing lines that Protestants had been doing for the last 80 years and so on. It kind of loosened the restraints.
And you're talking about literary historical criticism.
Which had virtually been banned from 1900 on, and I say a little bit about how that happened earlier on. But the main line is the École Biblique, the biblical school of Jerusalem, founded by Père Lagrange at the end of the 19th century, was persistent, had accumulated this magnificent body of scholars all around the biblical areas, and they produced this. The break was up until Divino Afflante Spiritu, everybody in the Catholic Church had to study the Latin Bible. You weren't allowed to publicly, at least, translate from Hebrew and Greek. You had to translate the Latin. They were freed from that, which enabled them then to publish translations based on Hebrew and Greek scholarship, which took them, and they were also allowed to recognize literary genre in the Bible. Not every word is literally true. Every word is as appropriate to the mode of speech or presentation that the biblical writers had been employing. So the scholars were now enabled. If you're reading a folk tale, you don't have the same expectations of it as you do of a newspaper report or a legal document.
Or a poem or a proverb.
Exactly. Sure. Though they were given, it was a releasing opportunity. So between 1943 and 1956, when the First Jerusalem Bible was published in French, scholars were working away on this. They were playing catch up, and they were. This was another one that was really fascinating to pursue and go into. We had a lot of Roman Catholic scholars in our graduate field before I left the university, so I was familiar with a lot of this. But the Jerusalem Bible represented the sea change, if you will, of Roman Catholicism, Roman Catholic biblical studies that Vatican II has come to symbolize for us all from the late 20th century on. In the beginning, I called it historic. It's historic for Protestants as well as Catholic, because the impact of this, if one reflects on it, are still rippling on through the American religious scene, that Roman Catholicism has the kind of stance on the Bible that the Jerusalem and the American New American Bible represent is of great significance to Protestants as well as Catholics.
And you point out in your review on thecommongood.org on study Bibles that their translation of the Psalms is particularly winsome.
Yes, right. All the time that I was doing the lectionary readings, every week you got a Psalm. And I read the Psalms in Hebrew, and I taught them, and so on. In a lectionary note, all you have time to do is to go through a translation that's given.
Sure.
But sometimes I realized I had come to recognize particularly the New Jerusalem Bible translations are just closer to the feel and the rhythm of Hebrew than any other translations I have read over the years, consistently, not always, but regularly. So often my treatment of a psalm in the lectionary studies is simply to give the New Jerusalem Bible translation, because you're familiar with something else, try this on for size. I think you'll like it.
We're talking with Dr. Jay Wilkinson about study Bibles today on Keeping the Faith. Let me give the phone numbers again. Perhaps listeners have heard enough. They might have a comment to make or an objection or mention something that hasn't been covered so far. 333-9455 in the 217 area code is a local number in Champaign-Urbana. You can also reach our engineer, Kyle Kroah by punching in if it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455. And then Kyle will put you on the line to be on the air live with our guest today talking about study Bibles. Well, let's talk about a couple that are maybe a little strange to some folks. What about the Orthodox study Bible? I'd never heard of it before, and apparently many Orthodox Christians haven't either.
Glad you asked that one. That proved to be the biggest adventure and challenge of the entire series so far. The Orthodox Study Bible that came out in 2008, an earlier version containing only the New Testament and Psalms, had come out in the mid-90s, was done by a group St. Athanasius Academy in California. And the story of that group, it takes about a third of my whole review just to tell that story. It's a group of people who started out as Crusade for Christ, Campus Crusade for Christ in
Protestant, evangelical, Southern, if not fundamentalist
right,
groups. Yeah.
Particularly in Southern California. Right. And a whole group of them who had worked in that movement for a few years gradually migrated as a group toward more formal structure, formal styles of religious church life. And over a course of 20 years period, they went from Campus Crusade so on to becoming churches, to being accepted in and ordained as priests in the Antiochian branch of the Orthodox Church, and they produced this Bible. I think, given the pilgrimage they had made, they did an impressive job of getting into the world and spirit of Orthodoxy, as you can catch it in a number of other places. I did find some review. I found a wide variety of attitudes and positions on this Bible, and I found some pretty sharp comments against this is not really Orthodox, and so on and so on. I'm not in a position to evaluate all that, but I could read a spectrum of responses or views of this Bible among Orthodox, and some were from one kind of spectrum, you would say, were very conservative. That is, they were very attached to the traditional modes of Orthodox Bible treatment and preaching, and so on. And they were very sensitive to particular holy days, to particular parts of the sanctuary, and so on and so on. But
for these folks to have gone from being mainly Baptist preachers to become Orthodox priests was quite a journey that you described,
indeed,
and then to produce this very odd Orthodox study Bible for the Antiochian branch of Orthodoxy, which is a fairly small branch of worldwide Orthodox Church, of course.
Yeah, it's now up to about, they count it as being close to 300 million worldwide. So, but it acquainted me with some local Orthodox churches, including an Antiochian church, which is just downtown Chicago here.
We have one here in Champaign-Urbana even. Yes.
Yeah, I just didn't know about all of these. I vaguely knew where they were, but I got a real sense of their concreteness and reality and the process of doing this review. It was, for me, it was the most mind-blowing of all of the reviews.
Well, Jay, let's talk a little bit. I've saved the last 6 minutes or so, seven maybe, to talk about the most famous study Bible of them all, the Scofield King James
Bible.
Version.
Right, I just recently did that.
The Scofield Reference Bible, which I grew up on, by the way.
Oh, all right, so I couldn't tell you anything new about
that. Oh, yes,
that.
You did, thank you.
When I made their original list, you know, I was very ambitious. I said, okay, we're going into 2011, I'll shoot to at least get 11 reviews done, one a month. Well, I wasn't able to sustain one a month through the year. But I made a list along this. I've got a whole lot of study Bibles accumulated during the time doing these lectures. And I did not include the Scofield Bible on it in the early stages. But as the year has gone along, and I've done a number of others, particularly after I had done the NIV study Bible and felt like, you know, I have visited the evangelical world and had a sense of it. I've just always had the Scofield Reference Bible around, and it had its 100th anniversary in 2009. And I've taught courses in churches and so on about dispensationalism. And if you're going to pay attention to dispensationalism, the Scofield Reference Bible is, by all counts, the most direct and, if you will, I love brevity. And Scofield was a genius at boiling it all down to a few basic statements.
Let's hear you briefly describe dispensationalism.
Dispensationalism. The present has all been a decreasing disaster. The only things positive lie in a future that will come by a very carefully worked out schedule that you have to know all the secrets about how to read in Daniel 9 and in 2 Thessalonians and in the book of Revelation. There's going to be the rapture. All the good folks are going to be whisked away by Jesus. You read about that in 1 Thessalonians 4. And then there's going to be 7 years of disaster, the tribulation, and so on. And at the end of that, the Messiah is going to come and rescue the Jewish folks, and most everybody left behind are going to become Jewish by that time, converted to Christianity because they're following the Messiah. Then comes the 1,000 years of good things under Christ's rule, and then comes eternal life at the end of that.
And so Scofield was a scholar when?
Born in the 1840s, died in 1921. He did his major work. He had his conversion. I mean, he just led an ordinary lawyerly life until he had a born-again experience in 1879, and he had become ordained in 1882 or 3. Between that and 1909, he had been a leader in popular literalist evangelical world, and his own needs describe how he should do his book. And he spent 20 years creating it, and it sold like mad. It was the first book that Oxford University Press sold more than a million copies of. There's a big world out there waiting for that book, and it's much of it's still out there.
And it's still in print. There's a new Scofield Reference Bible.
It's still in print with several different translations now. What they've done is, in recent times, they've transferred Scofield's original notes into, because it was done on the King James Bible, period. So it's now available in the NIV with Scofield notes, now the new King James Version, Scofield notes, and the Holcomb Study Bible, and most recently the ESV with Scofield notes. So it's available. The basic materials, viewpoints, are presented in the introductions and the notes, and these have been applied to a number of different translations in just recent time. So there's even more copies out there than ever.
Now, Jay, you can go through a whole university course, certainly undergraduate course, and maybe even all the way through your doctorate in biblical studies and never really encounter Scofield Reference Bible and this version of dispensationalism. How odd is it?
Scofield himself never went to seminary. He created a book that was for the lay folks out there. And they're the ones who bought it. They're the ones who read it. They're the ones who supported their preachers who used it and read it. It was the expansion of dispensationalism in American society from the 1920s to, you know, now has been an amazing thing to behold. But it was not generated and created by scholars.
What do scholars...
And it never has made its way into the... Well, it, where it has appeared, of course, is in histories of American religion.
Sure.
You can find references to it in Marty's History of American Religion.
Martin Marty, sure.
Right.
Sure. And what do biblical scholars... How do biblical scholars criticize it?
Well, there are evangelical scholars, of course. I mean, there's a vast array of evangelical scholars who, you know, first thing they do is they agree that the Bible is in some way or another literally true. And once you start out with that, you're in a different world than you are with historians who say what we read in the Bible is what Israelites believed at certain times and places, what early Christians believed at certain times and places. That's what we are studying. We're studying what they believed back there. We're not studying what is true somehow or another of our contemporary real world. Now, a true evangelical is reading exactly that. What's in the Bible is true of our the God we read of and hear somehow or another in the Bible is a God who we know and can know, at least, and relate to. And university scholars are not doing that. They may be doing their own life thing, but that's not what they're doing when they teach Bible in courses.
We've run out of time. I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Jay Wilcoxon, who is the author that's found on the website, thecommongood.org. His lectionary study aids that are very helpful under Read the Lectionary, and his introduction to various study Bibles that's found there as well. Will you be coming out with a book eventually about this, Jay?
It's not in the works.
I'd encourage it. This is
right.
A lot of very helpful stuff.
Well, thank you.
We are out of time, and again, thank you for being on the program.
Enjoyed being here, Steve. Thanks so much.
University YMCA, which is provided support for this program for many years, has Friday Forum lectures coming up here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Coming up on the next week is Wisdom on Wall Street. Reverend Axel Gehrman from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign will be speaking at the Y at noon on Friday. These are free lectures, open to the public. You can buy a lunch there at the Y Eatery, or you can bring a lunch or simply come and hear the lectures. February 24th, Matthew Winters, professor of political science at the U of I, will be the guest speaker, talking about post-Washington consensus and beyond. And the whole series is dealing with creative approaches to global development. That's at the University YMCA on the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street, right across from Lincoln Hall that's being repaired. Coming up on Keeping the Faith, next week, we'll be talking with someone who will be a guest at Hillel Foundation at the University of Illinois campus. February 19, we'll be talking with Jay Mickelson on the religious case for gay rights. Christopher Mitchell will be our guest here on Keeping the Faith, February 26, talking about the C.S. Lewis materials at the Wade Center found in Wheaton, Illinois. Those are some of the programs ahead, and I want to again encourage listeners to give to WILL 244-9455 or willpledge.org. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
I'm Sue Kapusinskas, a friend of WILL. There's strength in numbers. We've all heard that before. WILL is looking for 400 listeners to become supporters of our public radio station. When you make a contribution today in any amount, Common Ground Food Co-op will donate the cost of 8 meals to Eastern Illinois Food Bank. The more people who participate, the more powerful the impact will be. Call 217-244-9455 with your pledge.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
I've known Christy a few years.